The purpose of this lecture is to give some background on the blockade or the embargo, the term itself is contested, of Qatar that began in June 2017 and that, as of the time of speaking, almost 3 years later, is still in place. This is, needless to say, the longest rift within the almost 40-year history of the GCC since its creation in 1981. And it is also the most serious rift in Gulf politics, at least, since Saddam Hussein's invasion and 7-month occupation of Kuwait between August 1990 and February 1991. The rift has become stuck at a political level. All attempts to try and mediate a resolution politically have come to nothing. And as we approach the third anniversary of the rift, it seems as if it's something the Gulf partners across the world have to factor into decision-making and have to learn to live with for at least a foreseeable future. So in this lecture, I will begin by providing some historical analysis, some context as to how we got to where we are, why relations between Qatar and three of its Gulf Arab neighbors, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates became so strained. I will then briefly look at the blockade since 2017 of how it's gradually become stuck at a political level. I'll touch upon some of the hopes in 2019 for reconciliation or at least a partial thaw in relations between Qatar and Saudi Arabia and why they didn't materialize. And then finally, I'll look at some of the regional implications for Turkey and for Iran, and also for international partners of the Gulf states, such as the United Kingdom and the United States. The rift of 2017 is actually part of a longer-term process of estrangement that really goes back to the Arab Spring in 2011 and the policy responses taken to the upheaval across much of the Middle East and North Africa. Qatar initially very cautious, but gradually began to be more comfortable with the idea of the change and the demands for change sweeping through North African capitals, if less so in more neighboring states such as Bahrain and even Yemen. And the support given by Al Jazeera, based in Qatar, of course, to the, at least by broadcasting the iconic images from Tahrir Square in Cairo in February 2011. And then by broadcasting almost nonstop coverage of the sort of upheaval in Syria and in Libya in the spring of 2011, really made a firm imprint upon people across not just the region, but across the world. And Al Jazeera became almost synonymous with a lot of the coverage of the Arab Spring. And the Qataris also were more relaxed, shall we say, about the prospects that Islamist political groups might be the winners, the political winners, in terms of engaging in post-regime change states, political transitions, and also winning elections, as, of course, Mohamed Morsi did in Egypt in 2012. And perception took root across the region that Qatar was at least aligned with or sympathetic to groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood. And Qatar's sort of very prominent role, both in Libya and in Syria, also really entrenched the notion that the Qataris were more relaxed about the pace and direction of change across the Middle East after 2011. Set against this was the reaction in Saudi Arabia and in the United Arab Emirates. And when we talk about the UAE, we really talk about Abu Dhabi. The Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, is really the sort of the figure driving a lot of UAE policy making in the enforced absence of his older half-brother, the ruler of Abu Dhabi, and the president of the UAE, Sheikh Khalifa, who has been suffering from ill health at least since 2014 when he suffered a stroke. Mohammed bin Zayed, on the other hand, the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi, has a visceral dislike of Islamists and of political Islam. He feels this is an existential threat to regional security and stability. And especially since 2011, the UAE, under Mohammed bin Zayed's leadership, has led a countercharge to Qatar's sympathy with, or at least more sympathetic approach towards Islamist groups. Abu Dhabi's led the countercharge, the attempts to really crack down on Islamist organizations and groups within the UAE, across the Gulf, and as we see in Libya, especially throughout the wider region as well. And Saudi Arabia also, first under King Abdullah until 2015, and since then under King Salman and Mohammed bin Salman after he rose to influence, has also joined with the UAE and with Abu Dhabi to really provide a counter to the Qatari approach to the Arab Spring. So we saw these two very different approaches in 2011, between 2011 and 2013-14. Qataris aligning themselves on the side of protest movements in North Africa, demanding greater change and say in running affairs, and in many parts of the region also manifesting itself in Islamist actors winning or at least performing very well in elections, and the Saudis and the Emiratis are doing opposite. In 2013, in June, the Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Hamad bin Khalifa, stood down. He abdicated in favor of his 33-year-old son, Sheikh Tamim. 8 days later was the coup in Egypt, or at least the toppling of Mohamed Morsi by a military-led regime led by General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who of course is now the president of Egypt. There's no evidence that there's a link between the Emir of Qatar's abdication on the 25th of June and the Egyptian coup on the 3rd of July. But the fact remains that within a week of Sheikh Tamim becoming Emir of Qatar, he was faced with really the blowback from his father's Arab Spring policies and a concerted attempt by his regional neighbors to ensure that Qatar, in their view, could not return to its activist role in regional and foreign policy. The first signs of pressure on Qatar and on Emir Tamim came within weeks of his coming to power. In July 2013, there were reports channeled through Kuwait playing its mediating role it so often has, that the Saudis and Emiratis were unhappy with Qatar and wanted to ensure that the sort of the old guard from the father Emir's time, Sheikh Hamad's time, would no longer be able to call the shots or to be influential in Qatari policy making. They wanted to ensure that Qatar under Emir Tamim followed a path that was really very similar to the Saudi and Emirati perception of a Gulf consensus, which of course was their attempt to impose a consensus on the other states of the Gulf Cooperation Council. This led to a first iteration of the Gulf Rift in 2013-14, the forerunner of the blockade or the embargo that began in 2017. And the first iteration of the Rift began in November 2013, the same night that P5+1 and Iranian negotiators were announcing a climax of their initial meetings to set the stage for the subsequent negotiations for that culminated in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. That same night, King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia summoned Sheikh Tamim to a meeting in Saudi Arabia. And Sheikh Tamim was accompanied by the Emir of Kuwait, Sheikh Sabah, who is really the father figure, the elder statesman of Gulf politics. He was a foreign minister of Kuwait for more than 40 years. And he's been involved in regional diplomacy for almost 60 years now. And Sheikh Sabah from Kuwait insisted on accompanying Sheikh Tamim to the meeting with King Abdullah. The Saudi and also Emirati anchor, I think, was provoked by reports in US media, especially the Washington Post, that following the crackdown in Egypt on the Muslim Brotherhood in August 2013, the massacre in Rabia Square in Cairo, that a number of Egyptian members of the Muslim Brotherhood had managed to flee the country and had made their way to Doha in Qatar and were beginning to regroup and to plan what next steps they might be able to take. And for this, these reports seem to have crystallized the concern in Riyadh and Abu Dhabi that the Qatar under the new leadership would also effectively be more of the same. So the first iteration of pressure came when in November 2013, King Abdullah summoned Sheikh Tamim to Riyadh and presented him with an ultimatum to stop Qatar's support, as he saw it, of destabilizing groups. And he made, reports suggest he made Sheikh Tamim sign a pledge of compliance. 3 months later, in March 2014, the Saudis and Emiratis, also joining the Bahrainis, concluded in their assessment that the Qataris had not complied with the pledge they believed they had been signed in November 2013, And that was the pretext for the first iteration of this dispute, when in March 2014, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Bahrain simultaneously withdrew their ambassadors from Doha for what turned out to be a period of 9 months. The 2014 dispute took place from March until December 2014. During that dispute, Kuwait, as it did in 2017, tried to mediate more successfully than in 2017. The Kuwaitis shuttled between the different parties, taking messages. Qatar actually made a number of concessions. There were the relocation of Egyptian Muslim Brothers to Istanbul, for example, a group of UAE dissidents who had also made their home in Qatar were given a week to leave. They left, a number of them went to London and claimed political asylum. And Qatar eventually signed another agreement, a second Riyadh agreement in November 2014, where concessions included the closure of Al Jazeera's Egyptian branch channel, Al Jazeera Mubasha Misr, which again was a demand of the Qatar's regional critics. So there were a number of concessions made, and in November 2014, the Riyadh agreement seemed to have settled the Gulf dispute. And in 2015, for example, in September, the Qataris actually sent troops to join the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, not fighting in Yemen, but protecting the Saudi border against incursions from Houthi rebels. And the decision of the Qataris to actually contribute militarily to the coalition in Yemen appeared to signify that the rift of 2014 was over. And in fact, as late as December 2016, 6 months before the blockade began, King Salman actually paid a visit to Doha and was treated with full ceremonial honors. And he was in fact given a sword belonging to Qatar's founding father, and a sign of the brotherly relationship between the two countries. So from a Qatari perspective, the 2014 rift had been overcome and relations had been rebuilt. Qatar also joined in the GCC Internal Security Pact that had been formalized in 2013 and then implemented in 2015. So the Qataris actually were the first GCC state to ratify the agreement, even before the Saudis and the Emiratis. So by early 2017, it seemed that the events of 2014 were over. What changed was the international situation, I think, in the sense that the Trump administration had come to office in January 2017. And it seems that there was a pattern of interaction and outreach from the UAE and from Saudi Arabia, both directly and also using surrogates in DC. Looking at the Trump administration's accession to office as an opportunity to align the Trump administration with their regional objectives. And I think it's no coincidence that the blockade of Qatar began during that time, the opening months of the Trump administration's time in office, when it seemed that there were so many, the Trump administration was signaling that it didn't have as much strong as a regard for established and settled US policy interests than any of its predecessors have had. President Donald Trump, of course, made Saudi Arabia his first overseas visit as president in May 2017. He was received with a lavish ceremony by King Salman and by Mohammed bin Salman. And then 2 weeks later, the blockade of Qatar began. And the blockade of Qatar began with the hacking of the Qatar News Agency. The Qatar News Agency, the official state agency, was hacked in May 2017, just 2 days after President Trump's visit to Riyadh, and what we might call a fake news story was implanted, claiming that Sheikh Tamim, at a military graduation ceremony, had made comments that were heavily critical of the US, of other GCC states, and very sort of friendly towards Iran. That ceremony had indeed been attended by the emir, but he had made no public remarks at it. The fact that the blockade began, or the context of the blockade began with a hack, chimed with the first 6 months of zeitgeist in Washington, D.C., where you remember the term alternative facts was used by Kellyanne Conway, the president's senior advisor. This was a very much a an attempt to create an alternative fact that was then used as the pretext for a two-week campaign of media amplification of those remarks, and then a subsequent decision on the 5th of June 2017 to launch a political, economic, and sort of security isolation of Qatar. Within one day, of course, on the 6th of June, President Donald Trump himself joined the fray, initially tweeting in apparent support of the decision to take action against Qatar, and indicating that it had been discussed at some point during his time in Riyadh 2 weeks before. And President Trump's intervention, ostensibly on behalf of the Saudis and Emiratis, shocked the Qataris to the core. It brought into question for the first time the US security relationship, which since Britain's withdrawal from the Gulf in the 1970s, there was that initial decade when the Gulf states didn't really have an external guarantor, but gradually that had been filled by the US beginning in the mid to late 1980s. And that seemed to be called into question by Donald Trump's intervention on the 6th of June 2017. Sheikh Sabah of Kuwait engaged in a frenetic round of shuttle diplomacy in June and July 2017. And at the very least, he prevented any further escalation. There are all sorts of rumors about what may have been planned. So people in Doha, for example, convinced that some sort of military operation was being planned, although there's no open source, unclassified information in support of any view. Although the Emir of Kuwait in September 2017 traveled to the White House, and in a press conference with Donald Trump during the question and answer session, he did say, "Thanks God, what's important is we averted military intervention." And for such an experienced practitioner of diplomacy to have said something so deliberate indicated at least that something may have been planned, but that the Emir of Kuwait's shuttle diplomacy was instrumental in at least freezing the blockade and not preventing it from escalating. So we saw a decline of consensus within the Gulf between 2011 and 2017. We saw a polarization over responses to the Arab Spring. We saw also the 2014 Riyadh agreement that had been signed to end the first round of the Gulf dispute becoming heavily politicized in 2017 when the quartet of states blockading Qatar, Egypt, as well as Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and the UAE accused the Qataris of violating the Riyadh agreement. And then the Qataris responded by arguing that the quartet themselves had been the ones who had violated it by trying to intervene in Qatar's domestic affairs. We also saw extremely bad blood being spilled on media and social media platforms, patterns of insults. This dispute also differed from previous disputes in the Gulf, in the sense that previous disputes were very much elite to elite. They were government to government. Whereas the blockade aspect, the fact that citizens and residents of Qatar were forbidden from traveling to the three Gulf states that were blockading Qatar, meant that families themselves, individuals and families, felt the brunt of the impact. So this dispute really had a much deeper social as well as economic and political impact than previous disputes in the Gulf. The situation now, 2020, 3 years later, is that the dispute is stuck. It's stuck because no one party wants or believes they have to make the first move to offer concessions. The balance of interest or balance of power hasn't favored one side so decisively that a concession or a move towards compromise is necessary. The Qataris have restructured their trading arrangements, and so very quickly, within weeks in 2017, they developed workarounds. They worked very quickly to reach out to the US government at all levels to repair the damage, at least in their view, that had been done by the president's initial tweets in support of the move against them. And President Trump himself has swung round in favor of a resolution. So the Qataris don't feel they need to make the first move. And for the Saudis and Emiratis, they also can feel they can live with their decision. US displeasure has been communicated at the highest levels that the US wants this resolved, and it's not a helpful move. especially when US focuses so strongly on countering Iran and on the maximum pressure campaign. But the Saudis and Emiratis have resisted US pressure. And so we're stuck in a way where both sides feel the other needs to make the first move, and neither side is willing to do that. There were hopes towards the end of 2019, in October, November 2019, of a partial reconciliation between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. After the shock of the attacks on Saudi oil infrastructure in September 2019, the attacks on the Abqaiq oil processing facility and the Khurais oil field, the Qatar participated in a GCC Chiefs of Staff meeting in Riyadh and also joined the GCC communique that an attack on one is an attack on all, making it very clear that when push comes to shove, the Qataris remain a fully committed member of the GCC. And there were hopes in the aftermath of the attack that once again, when faced by a common external threat, in this case, Iran, and the pattern of incidents in the Gulf between May and September 2019, that external threat would, as it has in the past, bring the Gulf states closer together by putting into perspective the intra-Gulf issues when faced with an external threat perception. There were also hopes in December 2019 when Qatar hosted the football Cup of Nations, the Gulf Football Championships, that the blockade would be eased. Certainly Saudi and Bahraini football fans went to Doha. They actually crossed into Qatar for the first time in 3 years, and they met each other in the final. And the atmosphere in the final was very friendly. The Emir of Qatar himself presented a trophy to the winners, and there were hopes that that would lead to a reconciliation. That didn't happen. Partly, I think, because the Qataris were hoping to split the blockade by peeling Saudi Arabia off from the quartet. But for whatever reason, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Zayed in Abu Dhabi, the two crown princes who have a very close personal relationship, seem to have decided that Qatar was not an issue to potentially split that relationship over. The Saudis and Emiratis may well at some point have friction over Yemen, where they support different political groups within Yemen. But Qatar itself was not such a big issue for the two to risk a split over. So any hopes that the quartet might be split if Saudi Arabia could be peeled away ultimately came to nothing. And by January 2020, it was very clear that the dispute would continue. And even as the COVID-19 pandemic began to spread and the seriousness of what is again an external threat that faces all Gulf states regardless of geopolitics, we even saw a continuation of some of the issues, the sort of petty squabbling that has marked so much of this blockade. For example, the Qatari Minister of Health was reportedly denied a permit to travel to Saudi Arabia for a GCC health ministers meeting in February. And then at the end of March, there was a war of words between Bahrain and Qatar because the Qatar Airways had repatriated a group of Bahraini citizens from Iran, and the Bahrainis refused to take them in. So they became stranded in Qatar. And we saw a kind of continuation of just a lot of the sort of pettiness that has characterized a lot of the dispute. The fact, for example, that Mohammed bin Zayed in Abu Dhabi was willing to speak by telephone to Bashar al-Assad in Syria, but is not willing to speak to the Qatari leadership, also provides an indication of just how stuck this political issue is. Turning to some of the regional implications, the events of 2017 have hit on several weak points within the GCC. The GCC formed in 1981 when the six Gulf states came together in the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution in 1979 and the beginning of the Iran-Iraq War in 1980. So the impact of regional upheaval brought the six states closer together, realizing they were better together in the face of external threat. But the GCC from the beginning was unbalanced in the sense that you have one very large country, Saudi Arabia, surrounded by five much smaller ones. In fact, Saudi Arabia is seven times bigger in territorial size than Oman, which itself is larger than the other four Gulf states put together. So from the beginning, there was always a degree of concern in the smaller Gulf states, including in the UAE, including Abu Dhabi, about the possibility that the GCC would be Saudi top heavy, would be effectively Saudi Arabia plus other five others. And in fact, in the 2000s, there were a number of incidents between the Saudis and the Emiratis that would have indicated that that might be the next pressure point in the GCC, a Saudi-UAE clash. In 2009, for example, the decision to situate a GCC central bank for a planned monetary union in Riyadh rather than Abu Dhabi led the UAE to withdraw from the single currency project in fury, because they felt not only that the bank had been promised to Abu Dhabi, but that having it in Riyadh would just add further to the Saudi centricity of the GCC. Now, obviously, the Arab Spring recast the nature of Gulf politics, where Saudi Arabia and Abu Dhabi drew a lot closer. Qatar became the sort of estranged partner in their view. But the fact remains that there were still concerns in the smaller Gulf capitals about one large power potentially throwing its weight around, which is also why attempts in 2011 and 2014 by the Saudis to move the GCC into a more political form of union also failed. There was no real appetite in Abu Dhabi or in Kuwait or in Oman or in Qatar for a closer Saudi top-heavy project. So the sight of the Saudis throwing their weight around, joined by the UAE in 2017, has really hit the GCC on a weak point. It has cast into question the flexibility or the pragmatism within the GCC, where this is six states that have a certain amount of common interest, but on other issues they diverge. And the decision by the quartet of states blockading Qatar to issue a list of 12 demands on Qatar in 2017 that included, for example, cutting relations with Iran and downgrading ties with Turkey, really also presented an attempt by the Saudis and Emiratis to impose their regional policy will, almost like a geopolitical straitjacket. And that also had implications for how Kuwait and Oman, two other countries that had historically followed autonomous policies of their own towards Iran especially, it led to fears and concerns that they too would be targeted, if potentially, by the Saudis and Emiratis if they also continued to follow policies that diverged from the interests of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So the rift has hit the GCC at a weak point. And the GCC itself was almost remarkably absent from every level of the crisis. The GCC has a settlements dispute mechanism, which in theory could have been used to convey the grievances of the Saudis and Emiratis to Qatar, but it wasn't. The GCC was cut out both of the grievance process and then of the mediation process, which was led individually by Kuwait and intermittently supported by the United States. The fact that the GCC was unable to prevent three of its members from turning on a fourth, both in 2014 and 2017, and has since then remained largely silent, has meant that the GCC, although it survived, has survived in a weakened form. It's no longer a functioning political organization where the heads of state can meet politically and talk and discuss issues of common concern. The GCC has continued at a technocratic level. You have meetings of GCC ministers in specific fields, and they continue to take place. Many took place in the more neutral settings of Kuwait and Oman. So the GCC has survived in a weakened state, although the appointment in February 2020 of a Kuwaiti as the GCC Secretary General offers hope that at least one of the two balances, Kuwait and Oman, can at least try and at least make sure that the GCC continues. In terms of regional implications, Turkey was an interesting, has had an interesting aspect to it, because in 2017, the shock in Doha at the apparent loss of US support, at least in terms of Donald Trump's reaction, contrasted very sharply with the decision of the Turkish parliament to meet the next day in June 2017 and to accelerate the ratification of two agreements that had been signed previously that allowed Turkey to deploy troops to a base in Qatar, a Turkish base. And certainly from a Qatari perspective, it was that decision, the Turkish decision, to stand very publicly in support of Qatar that was critical to showing the Saudis and Emiratis that if you take further action, even military action, you take action against Turkey as well as Qatar. And from a Turkish perspective as well, the attempted coup attempt in July 2016 was seen as part of this continuation, where in 2016, the Saudis and Emiratis, in their view, in Turkey's view, had been implicated in an attempt to impose their will in Turkey. And now, 9 months later, or 10 months later, we're doing the same thing in Qatar. So Turkey-Qatar relations became very close politically and acquired a security dimension. And from the point of view in Doha, for the first time since 1990, it was not the US that had stepped in to protect and support a Gulf partner in a time of need, but it was Turkey. And this has had implications, and I think will have implications going forward as all Gulf states begin to ensure that they diversify their sources of security and defense partnerships, and they no longer have all their eggs in one basket, that you don't are no longer completely or over-reliant on any one partnership, which could potentially go sour at any point. The UAE has moved rapidly ahead with diversifying security relationships. Qatar has as well. Kuwait and Turkey have also become drawn closer as well. So the lesson of 2017 has certainly had an impact. And we also see Turkey-UAE regional tension and rivalry now being played out in Libya as well, for example. And in terms of Iran, the Iranians played an important role in terms of allowing or facilitating access for Qatar, given that its only land border was Saudi Arabia and much of the airspace surrounding Qatar was closed after 2017. So we saw a lot of air traffic from Qatar being routed through Iranian airspace. And there was also an increase in trade from Iran to Qatar in terms of trade flowing through Turkey and from other Central Asian states as well to Doha, then going over by ship from Iran to Qatar. From a US perspective, Donald Trump had called in Riyadh in May 2017 for the US's Gulf partners to come together and to combat and contain, as he saw it, Iran's destabilizing regional influence. But within 2 days, as we saw, the Gulf partners turned on each other instead. And it's certainly the case that the rift in the Gulf and the continuation of the rift continues to undermine the Trump administration's attempts to rally its regional partners to its maximum pressure campaign against Iran. So there's certainly a degree of frustration and friction within the White House that the rift has continued, even though there has been a pragmatic workaround, the creation of the Middle East Strategic Alliance, consisting of the 6 Gulf states plus US, Egypt, and Iraq, although Egypt pulled out in 2019. But again, that's a substitute, it's a poor substitute for a fully functioning GCC, where the GCC states are all on the same page in terms of combating Iran. Although the fact remains that even were it not for the Qatar rift, there's no GCC-wide consensus on Iran. We forget, for example, that in January 2017, the very week that Donald Trump took office, the Emir of Kuwait had led an attempt to try and reach out to the Iranian leadership to establish the parameters of an Iran-GCC dialogue to try and diffuse the tensions in the Gulf. The Iranians were receptive to a letter sent by the Emir of Kuwait in 2017. Iranian President Rouhani then traveled to Kuwait and to Oman in February 2017. So the Kuwaitis and Omanis also looked at the role that Iran plays, the way that Saudis and the UAE tried to use Qatar's relationship with Iran as a justification for the action taken against Qatar, that also caused shockwaves in Kuwait City and in Muscat, in terms of thinking that, will we be next if we continue to at least have a working relationship with Iran, because we have we have political and economic interests. We cannot change our geography. We have to live with our neighbors, whether we like it or not. And then just finally, moving towards implications for the United States and the United Kingdom. This is a difficult dispute for international partners, so the Gulf states, because unlike, for example, with Iran, there's no good side and bad side. There's no, we're on one side and the other side are our adversaries. From a UK or a US perspective, the Gulf states are all among the closest regional partners we have, politically, economically, in terms of investment, and security as well. And so the attempt in 2017 by the Emiratis and Saudis almost to try and create a situation where external actors would have to choose between one or the other was very serious. And it was also, I think, no coincidence that the United States especially put a lot of pressure on all the parties to the Gulf dispute to ensure that whatever happened at a political level to the rift, that it wouldn't affect the bottom line of security and defense cooperation and coordination. And there were initial suggestions that Qatar would be excluded from region-wide military exercises, and those continue to take place under a lot of US pressure. So there's been almost a feeling in DC that if the rift continues and it cannot be resolved politically, then at least ensure that it doesn't touch upon security and defense cooperation and coordination. And that has continued. And so from a US and a UK perspective, there's an acknowledgement at least that this rift is here to stay, but that other aspects of the relationship, especially on security and defense policy, continue unabated. The GCC also continues to function at a perhaps a lesser level than before. The fact, as I said, that there's now a Kuwaiti at its helm at least offers hope that whenever this dispute ends, if it ends, and the fact that the Saudi ambassador to the United Kingdom in 2019 used the analogy of Cuba suggests that, at least in the Saudi perspective, they think this might continue for quite a long time. But the fact that we now have a Kuwaiti in charge of the GCC offers hopes that, again, a level of policy coordination at a technocratic level, in areas where you can take politics and geopolitics out of the equation, will continue. There's also some hope that, at least with the de-escalation of Saudi and UAE and Iranian tension that we saw in 2019 in the aftermath of the incidents in the Gulf between May and September, that at least opens up the space for less of a zero-sum mentality to regional affairs. And we saw after the killing of General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq in January 2020, we did see a very different response from all parties in the Gulf in terms of pulling back from the brink and for calling for de-escalation. So there's at least some hope that some of the rhetoric that has been so polarizing from different sides, the unwillingness to see the point of view of the other side, might begin to be tempered, especially now that COVID-19 also really puts another common issue that faces all the Gulf states, regardless of their political or geopolitical stance. So these are some shoots of hope, shoots of recovery potentially, that the rift won't last forever. I think it's more likely to become background noise, to fade into the background where it's there, it still exists, but these pragmatic workarounds will ensure that at least the minimal level of cooperation coordination continues. So I think that's where we stand almost 3 years on. On June the 5th, we will have the third anniversary of the beginning of the blockade. Because no party wants to make the first move, it will continue. but I think increasingly it will become background noise as especially COVID-19 really changes the landscape of policy making and also challenges facing all the Gulf states and their international partners. But on a political level, it's stuck. But on military, security, and economic levels, we could see a new normal, as has been the phrase often used in recent weeks and months. So with that, thank you for listening, and goodbye.